Welcome to the Beyond Atheism podcast with me, Nathan Alexander, and my co-host, Todd Tavares. Moving beyond questions of God's existence, this podcast asks what atheists should be doing next in a godless world.
Why are certain countries or even certain regions more secular than others? We explore this question today by examining the history of irreligious behavior in the Pacific Northwest, especially the province of British Columbia, Canada, and Washington State in the United States. This region cuts across the Canada-US border and has long had a reputation for being more secular than the rest of the two countries, with lower church attendance, religious identity, and participation. To understand how this came to be, we are excited to be joined by Dr. Tina Block, an associate professor of history at Thompson's River University in Kamloops, British Columbia, the author of The Secular Northwest, Religion and Irreligion in Everyday Postwar Life, and the co-director with Anton Jansen of the International Society for Historians of Atheism, Secularism, and Humanism. Tina, welcome to the Beyond Atheism podcast.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm really happy to be here with you.
Thanks, Tina, for coming on. It's definitely exciting for me personally because it's some Canadian content on the podcast. I wonder if just as a way to start, if you can just sort of tell us a bit about your own background. So your book is about the Pacific Northwest. Are you from that area?
No, I am not from the Pacific Northwest, although I live in the Pacific Northwest now. So I live in Kamloops, British Columbia, which is in the interior of British Columbia, but I grew up in Calgary, Alberta, so a neighboring province, and then spent most of my youth and did my undergrad at Calgary, and then did my graduate schooling at Victoria, University of Victoria on the island in British Columbia, and then lived for a time in Ottawa, and then got a job at Thompson Rivers University in Kamloops, which is how I ended up back here. But I was, you know, when I started to undertake this project, I was living in the Pacific Northwest. I was living in Victoria, and that's certainly, you know, sort of part, you know, living in that context and reading stories about, you know, the unique secularity of the region and of British Columbia and Washington from, you know, this is right around to, like, at least in the Canadian context of census data coming out from the 2001 census. So this is quite a while ago. you know, data coming out about, and, you know, so reading headlines about, you know, British Columbia, most godless or least religious and that kind of thing, that kind of sparked my interest in the subject.
That's one of the interesting things about it, because when you look at post-war secularism, the U.S. at that time, U.S. is now still a pretty religious country, but I think of it as a very religious country, whereas I really don't know anything about Canadian religiosity at that time. And you're finding this is a very secular region, and it's got this twofold interest. One is you focus on the irreligion of a particular region, one that crosses national boundaries. Mm-hmm. That's surprising. And the other thing is secularism is particular to this region. Why should we think about it as a region on the one hand, and how secular are we talking in the 1950s and 60s?
Yeah, I think those are both really great questions. So both, so when you look at the Canadian data, and there's more data in the Canadian context, partly, you know, due to the requirements of the separation of church and state, questions regarding religion, as I'm sure you both know, aren't asked in the American census. So, but in Canada, there's this really rich source. I'm not saying the census is the be-all and the end-all by any stretch, but there is a rich source there. But there are, as I'm sure you both well know, many surveys and membership study, church membership studies and all that kind of stuff, which can be drawn on Gallup polls and so on. And so I wanted to do this sort of cross-border study because of the data that I was seeing, you know, from the surveys, from the census, from membership studies that really pointed to this kind of, and it wasn't, you know, I'm not the first person that came up with this. There were earlier studies that pointed to the sort of church membership trough sort of running up the West Coast, but that was particularly stark in British Columbia, Washington, and Oregon. And I basically just didn't do Oregon because, you know, because of time and resources. And so I decided to just to focus on Washington and British Columbia, but could have included Oregon in that analysis. So, and then as I dug sort of deeper into it and start to do research, I think there's a number of things that suggest that in terms of religion, this did constitute a kind of cross-border culture. And that's not to say that the national border, you know, had no meaning or didn't impact things. And as you suggest, Todd, certainly, and I do argue that in the book, you know, sort of the culture of religious belief, of, you know, sort of godliness, of sort of anti-atheism was undoubtedly stronger in the United States than it was in Canada, particularly in the 50s, but also into the 60s and beyond. But again, I felt like I found enough similarities within that region, you know, within British Columbia and Washington State to make this argument that in terms of sort of rejecting religious involvement, organized religious involvement, in particular, that there was, you know, a lot of similarities, and that it did sort of constitute the sort of cross-border secular culture, and that these commonalities distinguished that region in many ways from other parts of both Canada and the United States. Again, not to suggest that, you know, nation didn't have its pull in certain ways, and I do, you know, when it comes to talking about things like atheism and unbelief and certainly other aspects of irreligion, I do suggest that there were sort of more pressures around that, I guess, in the American context and in Washington State than in Canada. Although I do, you know, certainly in the 50s and 60s in Canada, in British Columbia, it wasn't easy to publicly declare one's atheism. And again, as you both know, my focus isn't explicitly on atheism in this book, but I do talk about it, and I do include that in the sort of my broader analysis of irreligion.
Part of the story of why the region is different probably relates to the experience of white settlers coming there in the 19th century. Maybe you can talk about that.
Sure. Thanks for that question, Nathan. And yeah, absolutely. I think a little bit about your work too, and I think about in your important work on race and atheism and so on. I know you're familiar with the work of Lynn Marks, who's has a book on irreligion in the late 19th century and early 20th century in British Columbia, who really dives into this issue. And she looks at, yeah, the extent to which irreligion was really embedded and entrenched by this sort of white settler male culture, embedded in the resource frontier of British Columbia, and very much associated with that. And she talks a lot in that work about, you know, issues of mobility, the fact that, you know, males outnumbered females in British Columbia in the late 19th century, talking about white European settler males outnumbered white European settler females by quite a large number at the time, and that irreligion, unbelief, you know, anti-church sentiment was really embedded and perpetuated by white settler males in, you know, the mining and lumber communities of British Columbia in that time period. And she talks a lot in that book also about the extent to which irreligion was intersected in the perpetuation and construction of irreligion intersected with racist ideas of the time, and how that secular identity among white male settlers was, part of that had to do, she argues, with the fact that religion was, race was so central as a dividing line in British Columbia at the time. And so these white settler, working class, largely men, could define their sort of respectability largely around their whiteness and their race, and really didn't need to be going to church and be religious to claim that respectability in ways that people, people may have in other regions where, religion was more central So race as sort of one of the key dividing line in that culture at the time, and just part of. And then she goes on to talk about how, you know, the churches certainly were perpetuating racist ideas at the time, but there were also church leaders who were sort of arguing against things like Chinese exclusion, and that this in some cases angered white settler, working class males who, you know, who were themselves perpetuating racist discourse against, for instance, Chinese workers who they believed were taking their jobs and things like that. And so that partly fueled anti-church sentiment among workers in the region. But then I know you were probably wanting me to link it to my work, which, you know, is moving into the post-war era. And Lynn and I have done some work together, sort of trying to tie those two stories together by like the late 40s and 50s and 60s, the time period that I'm looking at, the gender imbalance had settled out, had sort of leveled out quite a bit. So there wasn't this, you know, sort of huge imbalance of men, males to females in by the 1950s. But I do suggest that again, white settler male culture that was so bound up with secularity and irreligion and anti-church discourse, you know, really did become quite entrenched in British Columbia and in the broader Pacific Northwest, and that this association of this region with the sort of male resource frontier and with secularity, I argue, was, you know, sort of perpetuated over time. Even if it became less anchored to demography by that time, it was still part of the culture. And certainly by the time period that I'm looking at, the 50s and 60s, British Columbia, Washington, but British Columbia in particular, is still a very mobile place. So you still have that sort of more transient culture than in other places. But yeah, so there are connections between certainly her work and mine.
So what's interesting in your work is that you have both these sort of like these large scale, almost structural aspects, right? Mm-hmm. The way, the geography of it, the human flows that are going out, looking at it in these big pieces like class and gender. But you also find a lot of incredible personal stories and details that shape their lives in very specific ways. How, for the book, how many interviews did you conduct? How many people did you talk to?
Thank you, Todd. So for the book, I did 40 interviews. I think it's with 44 people. so a couple of them, some of them were with couples, and one I think with a mother and son. So I think it was about 40 people or so. But yeah, so those sort of personal, sort of idiosyncratic stories, I hope, sort of animate some of the other kinds of data that I include in the book. And as you suggest, Todd, some of these, you know, all of these stories are unique and and personal in many ways. But I did hope to in some ways draw on, you know, sort of recurrent patterns in the oral narratives. I know that 40 isn't a ton, but to use those narratives in, you know, in conjunction with, you know, the range of printed archival material and the statistical data to say something broader, even though, again, while at the same time foregrounding those kind of unique stories.
But I mean, I think it touched on a lot of things that you kind of can't find in the statistics, right? Like,
right.
There were things like, you know, just people talking about how pretty the trees are, right? Like, why do we need God if we have, like, we've got these mountains? Or like, you know, the leisure activity you can do, right? Like, there's so, why spend Sunday indoors if you can go out in the woods and you can go for a hike or go for a swim or whatever? But also things like the impact of what, how gender was lived, right? How these lived experience fleshed out. A church being gendered where the committees, the finance committee won't accept women, right? Or into leadership. Or the way the jobs worked that were different from the East Coast, right? It's not about factory work that has regular shifts or about going to an office. It's about a paper mill that runs 7 days a week. So
yeah,
I wonder, like, how much of this, what is it, if we're looking for a more generalizable story, is there something that you found that helps us think about the way this process is playing out today? Or is this something that's just very specific to the Northwest at a specific time?
I think that's a really good question. I would say that it's both. classic academic answer, right? So certainly there's things that are specific to the Pacific Northwest. And I mean, that's really what I wanted to do with this work. And still where, even though my more recent work is sort of focused more nationally and that kind of thing, I'm still always so interested in these questions about place and region and how or whether that matters. And I think it did. So it was unique. And there were unique things to that time period as well as that place, right? So the 60s in particular, you see, you know, a surge of de-Christianization, criticism of Christianity in the churches, and a sharp decline in certainly in organized religious involvement, not just in Canada, but in the States as well, and in Britain, and not just in British Columbia, but in and some of the unique things, I think, in the Pacific Northwest is that actually those changes were less dramatic in some ways because the Pacific Northwest had so long been sort of relatively, you know, religiously uninvolved, I guess, in a broader sense. So the sharp decline in organized religious involvement that the 60s and into the 70s that we saw in Canada didn't you know, impact British Columbia in particular as much as it did the rest of the country, although you do see that play out there. In terms of larger themes, well, I mean, the project that I'm doing more recently is interviews with, does involve sort of interviews explicitly with people who claim atheism or who have lost their belief or call themselves non-believers, and historically, so looking primarily at people who, you know, into the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and so on, lost or sort of never had any religious belief and claimed atheism. And so I see from, you know, thinking about the conversations I had for my book and the data that I had in my book and some of the quantitative or archival material that I included in my book, I see a lot of resonance with the stories that I'm hearing now from people across Canada, not just in British Columbia. One of the patterns that I see, again, not to deny, as Todd mentioned, the uniqueness of each individual story, is this sort of hesitancy around atheism, right? And to claim atheism or even non-belief, and that so many of these sort of journeys to unbelief, and I saw that in my book, in that earlier work, and I'm also seeing that in my more recent project, that people will sort of reject, you know, sort of actively reject organized religion or the churches in particular, and then only many years later sort of come to an active, you know, sort of a claiming of unbelief or atheism, if they ever do, right? A lot of times it's just sort of an indifference or, you know, Callum Brown, as you both probably know, Callum Brown has written a lot about this and has shown how often these journeys to unbelief were gradual and involved long, long periods of not thinking about God or issues of religion and so on. And that's, I would say, a pattern that I see in my more recent work with people I'm talking to today, and I saw in the book. And that was even in a place as secular, relatively and comparatively, as British Columbia, that's still something that I saw, and that I think, and that it was clear certainly in the 60s, 70s, and honestly, I still see it today, where people face stigma for openly calling themselves atheist, right? Whether that's and they would sort of change that. You know, change their identity or their, I guess their open identity based on, you know, where they were and who they were interacting with. So that I found that in my book from the earlier time period, and I'm finding that more recently as well.
Yeah, I think that indifference thing is something that I hadn't expected, but we've run into quite a bit lately. That in the, what's the other one? The SBNR. Spiritual but not religious. Which I think that's weird for us. That wasn't, I mean, I didn't go down a path of spiritual but not religious. What did, Nathan, were you ever in that category?
I don't think I was there, but I mean, well, another thing, Tina, that you mentioned in the book is this idea of like believing without belonging. And I think like, which means like, and that was for me for a time. Like, well, I mean, when I was a teenager, like I was raised a Christian, but I stopped attending church when I was a teenager, but I still definitely believed in God until then. I became an atheist later on. But I think like one of the interesting things about your book is that it does sort of show this diversity of non-religion. I mean, it's like just checking a box on a census, like that you don't have a religion. I mean, there's so much going on there, like so much sort of complexity and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And that sort of relates back to what Todd had said about, you know, the oral interviews can be really helpful in that regard. And they really do help to complicate the statistics, right? Because you have this statistic that says no religion or whatever. And when you talk to people, they often give far more complicated kinds of answers. But that whole belief without belonging, and my own trajectory is very similar to yours, Nathan, in my own life. I was raised Christian and sort of fell away from the church. And then, so it's sort of a similar trajectory as many of the people that I speak with. So I think the interviews help to point the way to more complicated understanding of irreligion and just a lot of indifference. But one thing I did want to point to in my book, which I think certainly British Columbia, the wider Pacific Northwest, has had a really large population of people who consider themselves spiritual but not religious, or are believers without belonging. And that's really the key argument I make in my book. But I also try to make the argument that there's also a lot of people, again, which relates to our earlier point about indifference, that don't call themselves atheists, don't call themselves unbelievers even, but also don't call themselves spiritual, right? That it's like they're just sort of, so I had hoped, or I'd wanted, at least in that book and also in my more recent work, to make room for that as well, right? Again, it relates to the, sort of the indifference of that active kind of, or passive, I guess, I don't know, disinterest. It's just not a part of their life. And I think Callum Brown has called it, you know, living their lives as if there is no God, but it's not like an active part of their thinking. Yeah.
But it sometimes is an active part of their life, right? With this ceremony and ritual, because there's a lived experience. For people who are indifferent or were indifferent in the 50s and 60s, how was it sort of these, I don't want to say holdovers, but how was religious ceremony, how did it become part of their lived experience and their lived culture?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. Like, how was it activated, and how was their, I guess, whether it's unbelief or their anti-religion or their disinterest or indifference? Like, they're living in a culture, certainly in the 50s and 60s. We can point to certainly strong strands of de-Christianization in the 60s, but they're still living in a culture where, you know, as I've already mentioned, atheism is, there's a pretty significant stigma attached to open atheism and unbelief. And where there's definitely this deep culture of belief and emphasis on Christian belonging and so on. So there's still, in the book I talk, I suggest that one of the key points in in people's lives when they're sort of compelled, I guess, to engage religion or to sort of actively reject it, take shape in relation to the family, right? So things like, and I had, you know, several of the people with whom I spoke, and I saw this also in some of the printed literature, would still baptize their children, or, you know, even if they were sort of even actively secular or unbelieving, they might send their children to Sunday school for a time because they didn't want their children to feel left out. But I also, within that context, try to make the argument, and again, I do want to pay sort of homage, I guess, to Callum Brown, because he has really very strongly tried to make that argument of seeing irreligion, non-religion, what is the word that he often uses, not no religionism, seeing it as not just this sort of, you know, passive thing, but as something that's sort of active and can involve like embracing sort of positive sorts of ways of being in the world. And so I wanted to also emphasize that there were, for instance, mothers who actively rejected that as well, right? Who felt that pressure. Most of them felt some pressure once they had children to say, again, give their, you know, christen their children or put their kids in Sunday school or do something like that. Or, but there were certainly not just women, but men and who actively rejected that. And I do make the argument that that was somewhat easier in the Pacific Northwest, but it still, I don't think, was easy. Or things like getting married in churches or celebrating religious holidays, all those sorts of things. And many people did those things, you know, out of joy as well, right? As they saw, you know, celebrating Christmas with family as a really wonderful, happy occasion, as a cultural kind of thing, and actively understood it in a secular way. And
so, do you know if it changed at all out in the West? This is, I mean, I'm just kind of projecting it into the future, because the story you're describing, I love that you use the word compelled, right? I think it is a sort of social compulsion. It's a social norm. This is the appropriate way to behave. Of course, you get married in a church and you baptize your kid and all that. But were there secular alternatives that developed? Were there things that were kind of like it, but not really religious that people did? Things like secular weddings, did those become more common? Or was it just like people going through the motions forever?
Right. I didn't see, I think that there are people studying that more now. I didn't see much evidence of that in my time period, if I'm looking at more like the 50s and 60s, but there was some of that. So the Humanist, the Humanist Association of Canada, especially if I'm focusing on the Canadian context, about which I would probably know a bit more, but the Humanist Association of Canada is established in the 60s, I think. Anyways, but the first Humanist Association, I believe, but I'm not certain, was established in Victoria in the early 50s, and then there's Humanist Associations established in Toronto and Montreal and so on. Anyways, but these organizations were sort of pushing for humanist wedding ceremonies, and I don't have, you know, a lot of evidence of those happening in any sort of significant way in British Columbia, at least by the 60s, but they were, I know for sure I know in either Toronto or Montreal, they had quite a large humanist Sunday school. And I'm pretty sure that was in the 60s to provide that alternative for people. So I do think humanist associations, which were quite small in this time period, but also growing, at least for a time there, that they were trying to carve out those alternatives. But and of course, civil marriages were happening. And I and the statistics do show that there was a higher percentage of people in British Columbia getting married in civil ceremonies. But again, in terms of like humanist Sunday schools and humanist, ceremonies and things like that, I think there were efforts to get those off the ground. But I don't think they were that common in the time period that I look at.
Yeah, it's interesting that like even it's such a lagging indicator, because it's the idea that like, it's so secular that the churches will freak out and complain that nobody's coming. But even when they do come to baptize their children, it may or may not be serious. They may not actually have any belief.
Yeah, that's so interesting that you would say that. That was happening so much in the, like, even the 50s, like, say in Canada, right, church involvement was really booming, but like the churches were always like, there was, you know, through the 50s and 60s, if you read through, you know, say the Canadian Churchman, which is the Anglican, you know, the National Anglican sort of magazine, just regular sort of cartoons that get at what you just said, Todd, where it's like this concern that people were just attending church for superficial kinds of reasons, right? So there was all this anxiety in the churches in the 50s and early 60s. That this boom in church involvement, church membership, church attendance was really just superficial, right? That people were just doing it as a show or as part of sort of suburban life.
Yeah,
and so on.
Or to date, right?
Where
girls
are, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
It's funny because like last week we were talking with Victoria Smolkin, who is studying the Soviet Union. And like, we were sort of talking about the similar kind of case where, I mean, obviously the Soviet Union was atheist, but the atheists were not really happy with how enthusiastic the people were, like in terms of their atheism.
Yeah.
But it's quite funny. I mean, like at the same time that there's this, in both
like literally the same time in the Soviet Union, the communists are complaining that it's not atheist enough.
Yes.
Yeah, oh man, that is funny, eh?
Yeah. I mean, another thing, the sort of theme that you talk about in the book is this idea of like independence and like wanting to be independent of institutions. And that this is somewhat like Well, maybe it's like a general characteristic, but I mean, in particular in the region, that since there is such a culture of, like, I guess, mobility, that many people had moved there, maybe from somewhere else, that there's sort of this desire for independence and so on.
Absolutely. And that's so, you know, when I started this project, I mean, one of the questions, of course, in my head was like, well, first it's like, is this, you know, was this region less religious? And then if so, and of course we could talk about how are we defining religion and religiosity and all that kind of stuff. But if it is, then why, right? So of course that's one of the questions, but it's like, I went through researching year after year, and I'm like, I don't have an answer to this question, right? Like, it's kind of like, you know, everything that I'm looking at is super interesting, and I'm learning a lot about what it meant to be non-religious in various ways and what that meant in people's lives, which is, you know, it's really where my interest lay anyway. But I really was like, well, how, you know, what's the answer to that larger question of why? And as you suggest, Nathan, that's one of the places that I landed, like towards the end of the book, was I started to sort of read into the sort of literature on place and cultural constructions of place and region, and then just trying to draw those sort of strands about how the Northwest was and continues to be constructed as this place of independence and linked to the frontier. And there's lots of course, problems with those constructions, and they are kind of imaginary and so on. But it is a strand that runs through many of the oral interviews, certainly runs through a lot of the printed archival material, church literature, and so on. This construction of the Pacific Northwest as this sort of independent, anti-authoritarian place, and that not being involved in religion was part of that in a really sort of, from the perspective of many people with whom I spoke, in a really positive way, right? And that, you know, I was trying to think of ways to sort of link those two. And I think in many people's, in telling their narratives, they did link those two concepts, as you suggest, Nathan, independence and, you know, I don't need the church as a crutch. And I, you know, mm-hmm. us, we here in the hardy Northwest, right, we don't need that church, the church as a crutch, and so on. And again, the extent to which that's grounded in reality, I don't know, but in terms of how the region has and continues to be constructed, I think tells us something about, or helps to explain, I guess, that secularity.
I had heard stuff like that when I was living in Seattle. That's where I attended grad school. And one of the things we would hear about, like if I asked locals, it would be things like, well, you know, like the churches got stuck in the mountains on the way over. They didn't quite make it all the way to the coast because even now, like, I mean, if you look at a place like Seattle, the demographically, it's changed completely over time. The makeup's changed. It's become very, like, especially universities are very transient, but the sort of tech firm culture has been a magnet for other people, but it's still, that story is still kind of perpetuated, that, like, yeah, we got out here and, you know, the churches didn't make it as far as we did. We're a different people. It's all about moving from somewhere else and leaving all that stuff behind. So it's definitely still part of that imagined community that shared historical narrative of people who started somewhere else and ended up there.
Right.
And didn't
That's
bring
super
that
interesting.
With them. Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting that you heard that. And yeah, and again, I heard that, well, I read it and then I heard it from the interviews, and often and then it's connected often to those ideals of being hardy and independent and often to, which very much belies the racist history of the region, but to this ideal of tolerance and being, accepting and freedom and those kinds of things. So yeah, it's quite interesting for sure. Mm.
One of the interesting things about, I guess we've already touched on it a little bit, but like the idea of mobility, and obviously it seems like it's a lot of cases of people moving, like when they're single and they're not bringing along a family. And that seemed to be, I guess, the importance for religion and family kind of working together. And if you're a single person, maybe there's less of that natural pull to a church, perhaps.
Absolutely. I think that that's a big part of the story, in my view, right? That, you know, religion often takes shape within families, religious practice anyway. And I'm finding that in some of my more recent work and interviews as well, just that, again, being away from family allows, in many cases, allows people to, yeah, stop going to church or to live as unbeliever, open unbelievers or so on and so on, right? So, and yeah, I found that for sure in the book that, and the fact that, as you suggest, Nathan, the fact that this region was more mobile than other places meant there were more people who were perhaps without, you know, single, without families, moving to this region or just moving away from their extended families. And you know, a lot of, as I suggested, again, a lot of religious practice just sort of perpetuates on itself, right, within a community. And if you're sort of in the same community, perhaps that you grew up with, and you've been going to church with your mom, you might continue to do that, whether in the same way that, as I write about in the book, you know, people might baptize their children or get married in a church, you know, out of respect for their families and maybe not so much for any sort of religious feeling. So yeah, I think being apart from families or and the fact that the region is more mobile has a lot to do with it, I think. Yeah, and historically for sure.
Yeah. And has it, so I guess the follow-up for us, because this is, you examine a period of time in the 50s and 60s. Do you know how it compares to the rest of the country now, both Washington's, or at least in BC? I'm pretty sure Washington State is still very secular compared to the U.S. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, as far as I know, well, certainly BC, yeah, and you're right, Todd, that I know less about the, you know, in present day about the Washington, but yeah, for sure, those, that regional distinction still holds. But I also think, at least, again, drawing on the census data, so thinking about the British Columbian context here, that distinction has narrowed over time, which I think is really interesting because it suggests, and again, I'm just thinking about the census data, the proportion of the population claiming that they have no religion, that has continued to grow in British Columbia, it's continued to grow across Canada, but that gap has narrowed. So, you know, the proportion of the population claiming no religion, like the stat I can remember from my book, I guess, was in 1971, I think it was a roughly 4% in Canada said they had no religion compared to 13% in British Columbia. And again, as we get closer to present day, it's still distinctly non-religious in British Columbia, but the gap has narrowed, which I think suggests that, you know, in some ways, a lot of the trends that have been happening in British Columbia are sort of happening elsewhere, right? So perhaps we could argue that British Columbia is at the forefront of broader national trends, and maybe we can argue that in the States too, but I'm, again, without the census data, I'm not as familiar.
Yeah, and do you know if, how is, has church, like religious composition, if that's the right word for it, like membership changed in, since the 1960s? Because I know, like, so at the time, Quebec was thoroughly Catholic. Has that remained? Like, you have a very Catholic region, you have very Anglican regions, or have there been shifts in what sort of religion people are?
I mean, that's a good question. I mean, I think Quebec is still largely Catholic, although, as with the rest of the country, well, and I mean, in Quebec, during the 60s, in terms of, certainly in terms of church involvement, there was a huge drop in Quebec. But the Catholic, it still has a large Catholic population and still associated with Catholicism. I don't know if there's been significant shifts over time in terms of, you know, sort of the denominations across Canada. The thing I guess that I would know most about is just that the 60s and 70s saw a substantial drop and that a drop across the country, certainly. There's a recent book on the Canadian context that explores it really in depth through quantitative sources, largely by Clark and MacDonald, I think. And it shows this really substantial drop in church involvement across Canada in, again, sort of starting in the 60s and then just sort of a landslide after that across the country. So yeah, I don't think, and then in terms of British Columbia, I know there's been some talk about how, and there was an earlier work Pilgrims in Lotus Land by Robert Birkinshaw. I think that's probably from the 1990s, that talked about how, although the United Church and the Anglican Church, these more sort of liberal or mainline churches really were declining, that sort of more evangelical churches were actually growing. So particularly like Pentecostal churches and so on. I think there's still quite a small minority, but I know he had some interesting things to say about that. So
yeah, but I'm just thinking like which way this secularization pressure, it sounds more like it's pretty one way. This is one of the things that we've read about secularism, and one of the things that we've conceptualized about it is it's very sticky, and that it doesn't, like, if you know Catholic parents usually have Catholic kids, atheist parents have atheist kids, and then they get kind of stuck, right? If you go from, there aren't many atheists who go to being Catholic, whereas there's more who go from Catholic to being atheist, and then that's it.
And right.
Yeah. So if that's, I'm wondering if that was playing out in Canada.
Yeah, that's such a good, I like that sort of metaphor of it being sticky. And I think absolutely that's playing out in Canada. I think recently Lynn Marks and I co-authored a piece for part of a larger research group out of the University of Victoria on religion and irreligion in the Pacific Northwest in what's often called Cascadia. And our piece is on, and it's based on interviews not done by me, but on irreligious families and members of irreligious families from different generations, right? And it's looking at the extent to which irreligion was and has been passed on within families across the 20th century and into the 21st century. And yeah, we argue that that's a big part of the story here is again to refer to your word, the stickiness of this. And that, yeah, I think that's absolutely a key part of it. It is passed on. You see people that go back and forth or whatever, but I think irreligion was and has been reproduced within families in the Pacific Northwest. And we found that in our work. And of course, there's sociologists who've done lots of interesting work on this. I'm thinking of Sarah Wilkins Laflamme and lots of other sociologists who look at irreligious socialization and how important that is. And then, of course, the flip side, religious socialization, as you suggest, Todd, super important too. And it's difficult to, you know, that's, you know, how you were raised. And I do touch on that a little bit in the book about the secular Northwest, about parenting and so on. But yeah, I think that's super important.
One of the things I guess we're trying to look at in the podcast is the link between politics and atheism or secularity. And it seems like in general that British Columbia and then in Washington in the U.S. are maybe more politically liberal than the two countries. Well, do you think this is right? And then does it have something to do with the secular nature of the region?
Yeah, I think that's such a good question. And it's something that, yeah, I think needs and maybe has been delved into more deeply, but not something that I delved into deeply. But I did talk in my book a bit how BC was seen as a communist fortress or right. something. Yeah. Or maybe it was Washington, I don't know. But both places had strong leftist communities and labor traditions, deep traditions of labor activism. And I think if I'm remembering correctly, British Columbia had, I don't know the statistics, but anyway, it's just a greater proportion of its population unionized than other provinces and so on. So and then, as you suggest, Nathan, there's also the political history. It seems to have, British Columbia has gone back and forth a lot, but it does have a strong sort of leftist liberal tradition. So I think there is a connection there. Again, it's not one that I've probed deeply. That's another question. I do think there are sort of sociologists who are working in present day are looking at a bit more and seeing if there are connections between voting behavior and irreligion. And I think there is something there. And I do, again, in the book, talk about the connections between that labor tradition and irreligion. But in terms of sort of politics more directly, in terms of voting and stuff like that, I haven't looked into that as direct. But I do suspect a connection for sure.
I think in a couple of the interviews that came up where people were either socialist or wobblies, and the wobblies were the IWW, the International Workers of the World, who are basically internationalist, anarcho-communist, really far left stuff. And that's something that, I mean, they are very specifically Western.
They
had a presence there. And it, one of the other connections it made for me was the, when you were talking about unionization, the longshoremen, who are a huge part of Seattle, and were radical at the time. They'd radicalized the whole coast in the 20s and 30s. They're one of the only truly international unions in the U.S. And I think it's just like, it's the West Coast and Canada. They have like connections between the Vancouver, Victoria, longshoremen, and Seattle, San Francisco. So these aspects of like, there seems to be this overlap between regionalism, that shared sort of culture, that shared sort of politics, and irreligion.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you're kind of reminding me of certain aspects of my book too about, because there was, definitely some discussion and a couple interviews that talked about and socialist connections to socialist traditions and the IWW, and again that connects to Lynn Mark's work on the earlier time period for sure. I think that's a part of the story for sure.
Well, maybe I think the time has flown by really quickly. Maybe just to sort of just to wrap up. I mean, like you sort of talked about your current research, like here and there, but can you tell us, like, what are you currently working on now?
Sure, thanks, Nathan. So in the book, my focus was on the sort of the vague category of the religiously uninvolved. And so there were some, certainly some among my interviewees who were non-believers or atheists, but I think the larger proportion were still, believers, but sort of just not involved in an organized religion. And so, and then in doing that study, I talk a bit in the book about a woman I came across in the archives by the name of Marion Sherman. And she was an active vocal atheist in Victoria, British Columbia between 1946 and her death in 1975. And I mentioned her a bit in the book, but it certainly wasn't a focus. But I was really drawn into her story, and her papers include, because she would, she would be interviewed on CBC about her vocal atheism, and she was just very vocal about it. And so her papers at the UBC or the BC archives contain letters from people from across Canada, and some from the States as well, from mostly these are letters that are thanking her for being open about her atheism. And a lot of people would say, well, I can't speak about my atheism because I'll lose my job, but I'm so thankful that you're doing this, and that kind of thing. Anyways, so certainly reading those papers and about her experience, and also just the research for the book more broadly, just made me want to start sort of look more closely at the subject of unbelief and atheism across Canada. So that's really where my work lies right now. So I've done some interviews in many in British Columbia, and it's often easier for me to find people to interview in British Columbia, which may relate to the topic of our discussion today.
Right. Of course.
But I did interview a number of people in Ontario as well, and I'm hoping to expand that to other provinces, doing other sorts of research, similar kind of research that I did for the book, but looking more explicitly at atheism and unbelief, and trying to do a national study. So that's where my focus is right now.
Wow. Cool. Yeah, it's gonna be great. Well, please come back when
when
you've got more. We'd love to hear about that. We'd love to talk to you more. This was fantastic.
I would love to. Thank you.
That was fun to talk with Tina. Yeah, so what did you think about it?
It's amazing. Any thoughts? It's another book that's really rich. It's got this great top-down perspective from the church that's almost contradicted by the bottom-up view. And part of it is just, it's not so much an explanation of how it happened. It's more a description of what it was like. And I think it's something that do you think it's an accurate depiction of what we're experiencing now? Because there's a lot of overlap, right? One of the things she points out is, even though it's known for being irreligious, there's very, very few atheists, right?
Yeah, that's true, right? Yeah, I think that was one interesting thing about the book. And even some of the other interviews that we did, so far in the podcast, this sort of middle ground, I guess, between religious people and then the sort of convinced atheists or open self-proclaimed atheists.
Yeah.
There is, like, that seems to be among sort of the people who are fall under the label of non-religious. It seems to be more common that there are these people who, you know, they don't go to church and they don't identify with a religion, but they're at the same time, they're not calling themselves atheists.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, I mean, what to, like, what to sort of do with these people, basically. Yeah.
So one of the things it makes me think is that that might just kind of be the default position of most people, right?
That's like, true, yeah.
That's just what we are. And if you live in a very, you put those people in a very, very religious context, they become religious. Or you put them in a less religious context, they're less religious. And you put them in a completely secular context and they end up completely secular.
Yeah, that's
true. Put
them
in a pagan one, you get pagans, something like that.
Yeah, that's true.
Because so much of this, like with Victoria Smolkin in the Soviet example, so much of it was about the lived experience. Right. It's not about the intellectual ideas shaping the world. It's about what you do every day and how you relate and connect to other people. And that's super important.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's what I think stood out to me.
And I think another thing is just that there are just some people who are not joiners, sort of, that like they don't feel the need to have that community. I mean, or I guess they find it in different ways, maybe.
Yeah, right. You find what's available or you make it your own. Especially like related to this is just that sort of the cultural indifference to religion. Mm-hmm. And this also came up with Victoria. But this idea, like, you don't need to do it, right? There's no one coercing you to do it. If you are religious, that's fine. If you're not religious, that's also fine. And when we think of a secular society, I think for most atheists, that's the position we want, where there's no one sort of coercing you or compelling you to become a religious person, to do these religious things, to behave in a specific prescribed fashion. And that makes a big difference. Because in like what we there are lots of things we didn't talk about. The things like atheists can't get government jobs, right? That was a law that was coercive. That's gone, right? We don't need to worry about that anymore. So people can drop out of religion with no worry. But for a lot of the world, and even I would say there are definitely communities in America, definitely in Canada, where you have to be a member of a church. And not just in Utah, not just the Deep South, where it's mandatory. Basically, it's mandated by society. You're not going to be able to get a job if you're not a member. You're not going to be able to have that social capital. And that mark of secularism that we want is where you don't need to do that. You don't need to proclaim things to be true that we know are not true. You don't have to kneel before a God who is not there, who's just people demanding you comply with them. That indifference is, I mean, it's nice to see in that it existed, right? That there are places where it was already like that. And what happens when you do that, when you treat people freely, they behave freely.
Yeah. One thing I was thinking about, like the sort of indifferent people and the non-religious, but not atheist, but not Christian or any other religion, is just like sort of from a political perspective, presumably if one is interested in kind of mobilizing like a secular coalition, sort of obviously like the atheists are sort of on board, but like how to get the indifferent kind of interested, because obviously they don't want to have religion controlling their lives or anything like that. So how do you mobilize them politically, I guess, is kind of a question, perhaps.
Yeah, and I mean, this is something where the historical works don't really tackle, right? Because there's some things about labor flows, right? Like people moving to new places, things about like the length of the day or how much money you have, or just you disagree with the church, I think. And we've seen that here too, right? Lots of people, the church is against homosexuals, so they leave the church.
Yeah.
Right? Because they're gay or their friends are gay or something like that. Other than just like disagreeing with the church, how do you do it? Well, I think there's definitely the legal ones, right? You get rid of these legal prescriptions where you can't be an atheist and have a government job. But another part that there's no one really directly in control is you change that lived culture, right? One of the big things in the book that Tina wrote about was ritual, right? So even though it's a very secular place, people still get married in churches because it's nice. And they still get their children baptized because, you know, it's what the family wants. So how do we change our family culture? How do we change our live experience? How do we change our ceremonies? And I don't know, do you have any like non-religious rituals? Like annual traditions that are irreligious?
Well, I don't know, birthdays, I suppose. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure.
I mean, we got the big ones, you know, like in the U.S., we've got the 4th of July and Labor Day and Christmas and New Year's. None of those are religious. Like, yeah, like for Christmas, people still celebrate Christmas with a tree and gifts, even though they don't have the religious aspect. But like weddings, funerals, these are things that are there. What are the secular alternatives? What are they like?
Yeah.
And how do we live them?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's like a wedding or something. Like, obviously it would be cool to get married, like in a cool building. I mean, talking about, last week with Victoria, there was the, like the Palace of Weddings or something in the Soviet Union. And I mean, I guess people do that now. Like they choose, if they're not getting married in a church, like they choose like a nice location or wherever, like a outdoor location that's very scenic or something like that.
Yeah.
But it would be cool. I mean, like to have a 200-year-old building or whatever that is really, really cool, but it's totally secular. I mean,
right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's like, the way to do it.
Like cool architecture and like art on the walls and stuff like that. Yeah.
And I mean, and this is something I wonder how many people are like, what percentage of weddings are still religious? Mm-hmm. That'd be interesting. Mm-hmm. We need a divorce ceremony. I think that would do it. If there's a secular divorce ceremony, that's how you start pulling people over to your side, right? Because it's the religious people, they get divorced all the time. They don't have a ceremony for that. They don't have a ritual. Secular people, come up with a ritual. And when you do, you can hit me up on Twitter at Nath Galexander.
Yes.
And we'll share that and we'll make sure everybody's got a, you know, the birth ceremony, a secular birth ceremony, a secular naming ceremony, secular birthday, secular divorce ceremony.
It would be nice, I think.
Yeah.
Nice.
Divorce ceremony. How are we going to change the lived experience? That's.
Yeah. Yeah.
Something. And, you know, it's something we should think about going forward. Fine. Mm-hmm. Think about ways that's been changed and how it's been changed.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Anyway. Yep. Big thanks to Tina. Another great guest. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is fantastic. I have nothing to plug.
No.
Can't find me anywhere on the internet. I don't exist.
No. Yeah.
Do you have anything coming up people can check out?
I'm supposed to be presenting at... I need to find out I think it's June 17th on this conference that I think people are able to attend virtually, but I'll sort of, I don't know. I need to find the details, but I'll post it in the description, I guess.
Yeah. Link and details will be in the description and that'll be fantastic.
Yes.
Big thanks to Red Japan for the music. Anything else? Or is that just it? All the business done?
Like and subscribe and rate and review and etc. etc. Yes.
Ring the bell, pull the string, feed the dog. I don't know what else you need to do. Smash a button.
Smash the like button, enough just to click it. You need to smash it.
Get in there and smash it.
Yeah.
Secularism.
Yeah.
It is a ritual.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
All right. Fantastic. Until next time.